Good morning, everyone. It's a real privilege to be here, and I do community outreach and engagement for the Center of Excellence in Environmental Toxicology at the University of Pennsylvania, and I have nothing to disclose. As you know, there are lots of different kinds of disasters. There are natural disasters, and in some cases, some disasters occur at the same time. With hurricanes, we often have flooding. Some disasters are ones that we know about in advance. We often get warnings about hurricanes. We get warnings about some tornadoes. There are things that we can anticipate at times. Some disasters, though, are man-made, and in many of these, we do not have a warning. We can assess a risk, perhaps, and so, for instance, if you look at the Texas, the bottom picture here, the Texas fertilizer factory that blew up, there, by very the existence of that factory in a community, there was a certain risk that something could happen. The awareness of that risk by community members and by the owners or operators of the industry may be very different, and that's part of what we'll talk about today. But I think that it's very important to understand that there are different kinds of disasters, and the communication message and environmental health literacy around them may be very different. When we look at the World Health Organization or FEMA, we look at their messages, and they have very simple messages: be informed, make a plan, make a kit, some very, very specific messages. But when you actually look at what the information they have on their site, it is actually requiring people to have background environmental health literacy to understand. Why should you make a kit? Well, why should I take the effort to go and do that? What is the reason for it? Why is it important? And in fact, what if I don't? You know, I never needed a kit before. I, you know, don't really understand what I do with those things in the kit. What is the purpose? And it seems that some of our organizations have assumed a level of environmental health literacy that just really isn't there. And I view this required level of environmental health literacy as a certain amount of insight that informs our decision making. And so at the most basic level, just the decision to evacuate is really informed by an understanding of a number of things, recognizing physical hazards that might occur in the face of a disaster, a fire that might be reasonably anticipated, or unsafe structures that maybe your home will not be a safe environment, maybe it will fall down around you, electrical hazards, chemical hazards of unsafe water, flood waters that come into your home may contaminate it with a whole variety of chemicals, and what those risks might be. Disruption of wildlife. You may have been perfectly comfortable living with the alligators and snakes down there in the bayou, but frankly, in your living room, not so much. There are other problems that may not be anticipated as well. Isolation, inability to get your medicine, not able to have electricity for long periods of time. And then your personal security. Those who you rely on to perhaps protect you may be doing other things, and so your personal belongings and your own personal security may really not be as protected. So do communities at high risk of disasters have adequate environmental health literacy in order to inform their decisions? And so I'd like to use some Gulf states, the Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama, as examples to answer that question. It's very difficult to assess true environmental health literacy, the kind of environmental health literacy that we know would be relevant to thinking about disasters and what you do in a disaster. But I think a reasonable surrogate is the survey that the National Science Foundation does on an annual basis, looking at science and engineering kind of proficiency. And this is the rate. This graph here shows the 8th grade science proficiency. Now, I'll remind you that by 8th grade, people in general have not had much biology, haven't had much chemistry, haven't had much physics. All those things are things that we might learn in high school. So we're talking about basic science kind of proficiency. The U.S. population as a whole has an 8th grade science proficiency of just above 30%. which is in and of itself quite concerning. But if you look at these three states, they really are hovering around 20%, with Louisiana being just above and the other two being just below. That means one in five people in these areas have at least an eighth grade proficiency with science, recognizing that the other four out of five have less. If we look at the timeline around disasters, you'll see that there is, for disasters that we actually can predict, there is a time when the disaster is predicted. There is a time when the disaster is imminent, it's just about to occur, the time of the disaster, and the time immediately thereafter. We know that during disasters and immediately after, people are often in a panic. Things have happened that they didn't expect. They've lost perhaps loved ones, they've been injured, they've lost their property. There's every reason to expect panic, and the panic actually happens. And we know that during this panic, people are not taking constructive action and are not really framed to really accept information very well. Just before a disaster, people are afraid. Some people are panicked, but most people are just afraid. They're afraid about what could happen. It hasn't happened yet, but it could happen. And similarly, a little early on when things are first predicted, there is some number of people who are afraid, but some people are just concerned. And I would suggest to you that concern, the time of concern and fear, is really a much better time to actually take in data and perform constructive action. Actually do functionally use the information that you might be provided. But when we look at when information is provided and when that information is, what it's geared to, your FEMA recommendations to make your kit and how to do the evacuation and what to do in the immediate aftermath are really framed more around the time when people would be very fearful and panicked. Less so in the time frame when they'd be most able to accept information. And I would suggest that in that disaster, when disaster is predicted, and the time before and before the next disaster, that's really an opportunity to enhance environmental health literacy by giving messages that really would be more easily incorporated into one's understanding and allow for positive change. If we look at the NOAA map of incidents, significant incidents, we see that they tend to cluster, and this is no surprise. If you look at the Gulf, a big cluster of incidents requiring significant mobilization of resources. And so if we think about a place like the Gulf, where there are many oil spills and hurricanes and lots of challenges that come one after another, there are lots of benefits of enhancing environmental health literacy between these events, these expected events. The population is still concerned about an event. They may be more receptive to information and to take constructive action. They're less suspicious of the messenger at that time because no one's trying to say that they're doing a great job in responding, or that, oh no, in fact, it wasn't my fault. I'm not taking responsibility for that, or my responsibility is just this little bit. So the messengers are more trusted because they have less of an agenda. It will allow a population to gain insight and resources that can be used for the next event and enhance their communication and enhance networking. I'd like to tell you about a consortium that I've had the privilege to be part of. It's the GC HARMS. It is one of the consortia, multiple consortia, funded by the NIEHS to look at hazards and effects of the BP or Macondo oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. As you can see, there are a number of academic institutions led by the University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston that are involved, as well as a number of community-based organizations representing organizations of a variety of ethnicities and from all three states, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama. The research projects involve a number. There's a longitudinal clinical cohort study of coastal residents to look at health effects, toxicology studies to look at the effects of oil and weathered oil, exposure assessment of seafood from the impacted areas, which involved the collection of seafood and actually testing of various seafood items. community vulnerability and resilience, as well as community outreach and dissemination of information. But before you start any kind of community outreach and dissemination, it is very important to understand your community. And looking at the Gulf Coast communities, there are a number of very important factors to consider. These communities are marginalized, largely due to race, ethnicity, language barriers, socioeconomic and educational problems. They are already environmentally challenged with a lot of heavy industry in the area. And in fact, they lack trust in messengers because they have been, they've heard messages that are conflicting at the same time over and over. So there is a real lack of trust in this area. Generally, people trust physicians to get their health messaging the most and other medical providers. But in this area, although there are many environmental health physicians, physicians with environmental health background, occupational environmental medicine physicians, they often are employed by clinics and do not take personal insurance or accept private patients. And so we found very few in the area who really could provide this service to the general public. You also have to recognize that these folks in these communities have had fishing as part of their subsistence and as part of their livelihood. So it's been interrupted over and over. They've had repeated hurricanes and oil spills. And perhaps it's for all of these reasons that they are very accepting of the community-based participatory research model because of its tendency to be an equalizer. It is an opportunity for communities to really participate in every aspect of research, in the design of the project, in the analysis of the result, in this case you'll see in the collection of actually data, and also in the communication model. And so we have found that it's worked particularly well. In this project, the GC Harms seafood sampling was done out of four different hubs. One with the United Houma Nation in Louisiana, the Mississippi Coalition of Vietnamese American Fisherfolk, and then the Alabama Fisheries Cooperative in Alabama, and the Louisiana Environmental Action Network also in Louisiana. In this process, about 75 fishermen were trained, actually by Wilma Subra and John Sullivan sitting in the audience. Thank you very much. And they were trained, and in this training process, they learned a lot about research, a lot about belonging to an important project that was really relevant to them and their communities. They learned how to collect the specimens. They learned some examples of toxicology in that they needed to extract the liver specifically and put it separate because it would be tested for its breakdown of the oil constituents. And so in the process, there was a whole lot of features that were really relevant. And they actually tested all of these different kinds of seafood samples. I'm going to have to hurry. In addition to the actual fishermen and what they learned in this process, there was a community outreach effort to the various hubs. The seafood results of the sample assays were discussed. We discussed risk, the strength and limitations of risk assessment itself, and the difficulties in interpreting guidance. We developed content for the web and also developed a dissemination plan based on community communication preferences, and that process is really ongoing right now. But probably the most important piece is the trusted messenger concept in the CBPR project. The community members, the hubs that we enlisted as part of the process, are the trusted messengers. They're the ones that brought in the fishermen who actually brought us the specimens, the real data, and as well as will be the communicators of the message when the data is widely published and sent out to the community members. They collaborate to create the knowledge, and I think that is particularly useful for people with kinesthetic and social learning styles. The fishermen who really filleted the fish and actually did that kind of work and learned by it. They were included in the data collection process, and investing time motivates people. Science experiments motivate people. Who remembers putting a saltine on their tongue in maybe second grade or third grade and learning that starch turns to sugar? I always think about that when I think about what we've done here is really engaged people in the science process and the science experiment to clarify specifics of what was tested, why it was tested, and how it was tested. In addition, we had the opportunity to teach basic science concepts that will actually enhance understanding for in the future. We taught about exposure assessment, talking about inhalation, ingestion, and dermal pathways. Risk assessment, risk perception, voluntary versus involuntary risk, familiar versus unfamiliar risk, and why that's perceived differently. The meaning of concentration and levels of concern. How the environment causes cancer, and how the body responds to carcinogens, and very specific standards that are needed to maintain credibility of science. All of these concepts were part of this process. Just to give you a couple of examples of some of the very simple ways that we conveyed some of this, putting risk in the context of other more familiar risks. We told people about how your yearly risk of dying in a car accident was 1 in 84, but your yearly risk of dying of a shark attack was 1 in more than 3 million. Simple messages like this can really go a long way. We also talked about various exposures that go into the carcinogenic model. Exposures from a variety of areas causing 4 of 10 Americans to be diagnosed with cancer in the course of their lifetime. And measuring effectiveness is, I think, our next challenge. But I think, thinking back to Liam's model, I think we have a number of those steps in this process. We have shown that there are enhanced collaborations and enhanced networking among our community-based organizations. We've received unsolicited calls from our community organizations asking very specific science questions that really clarify that they've really gotten the message and learned things. We've gotten calls from fishermen who are looking for results, who will actually change their fishing patterns based on their understanding of where things may be less contaminated. We've done outreach to physicians, or in the process of doing outreach to physicians, to actually help them connect with resources of other doctors with environmental expertise. And we've had open discussions about how the communication message should be given. And we've received very good feedback from our partners who had to understand the message in order to really distill it in a way that would be best for their own personal communities. And we're in the process of conducting some surveys right now of participants, and we'll see from there what we find. So would this be an acceptable model, or would this work in other disasters? Well, I think whenever a disaster is expected, there's no reason why this kind of a model couldn't work. So if a population knows that there's a history of recurrence of that kind of disaster, if they recognize already that there are serious consequences to be had and that they'd like to avoid those and recognize that, in fact, their livelihood may be challenged, these are reasons why this kind of model could work. But when things are unexpected, so maybe the chemical plant that people didn't recognize as a hazard, terrorism, maybe it would be a little harder. But again, I think that we should not close that door because there may be some opportunities there. I'd like to very much thank my collaborators, John Sullivan, who did all of the field work, Sharon Croissant, who's the PI of the Community Outreach and Dissemination Corps. They're both from the University of Texas Medical Branch, and all of our other community partners. Thank you.